From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, architecture critic Tom Bamberger explains why he thinks the design of the new Northwestern Mutual Tower works so well.
Good buildings have to have an ego. They have to have somebody that really wants to make it nice.
Then author Marnie Maminga and her husband find themselves with a flat tire in the North Woods of Wisconsin and find they have to actually use the owner's manual.
Oh, the shame of it, the shame. What dignified, self-respecting person ever reads the owner's manual? And while I'm at it, whatever happened to the good old days when a jack was a jack?
Radio Chip Stone visits the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend to explore the exhibition of children's clothes designed by Milwaukee native Florence Eisman.
And we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If you've been downtown in the last year, you've noticed the entire city seems to be under construction. But one notable project is nearing its completion. The Northwestern Mutual Tower at the end of Wisconsin Avenue is the latest addition to the city's skyline, coming up just a few feet shorter than the U.S. Bank building across the street.
But those buildings couldn't be more different in style. Critic Tom Bamberger, who's not always been a fan of recent major projects, says this one is an architectural triumph, writing on Urban Milwaukee that this is Milwaukee's, quote, first great glassy skyscraper. Tom Bamberger, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Bonnie.
So I had to ask you to come in and talk about this because I think in all the years you and I have been talking, this is the first one that is almost 100% positive, this review. I don't know that I have ever read a review of yours where you were so almost effervescent in your praise. And so tell me about the Northwestern Mutual Tower. Why is it such a good building?
Well, first of all, I have written other positive reviews.
Oh, I'm sure, but just you and I haven't talked
Maybe
about
we haven't,
them.
Yeah. But the funny thing is that people really like the negative. They really remember the negative ones. When I see them on the street, they say, oh, I love that review. But then how come you don't ever write positive reviews? Anyways, so yeah, I do write positive reviews. But in any case, the Northwestern Mutual building is, you know, they tried. You know, there's so many buildings in Milwaukee. One of the things that I found fascinating with the reception of the article is so many people like yourself said, oh, my God, I like it. You know, it's on the web. So and people say, you know, I like it and you like it and thanks for showing me, you know, giving me a language to maybe understand it better visually. That's something I try to do. But the bigger point in the article that no one has talked to me about yet is the reason why the building is so good. And if you look around Milwaukee, and I've always thought about this for years, really. If you look around Milwaukee, almost all the buildings we admire are buildings that had to make a statement of some sort. They had to mean something. Now, churches used to be like that. They had to mean something. City Hall, when it was built, had to mean something. It has to do with a fiction. In other words, people have to believe in government. You can't see it, but then this is a symbolic representation of government. And the same thing with corporate headquarters. So if you look at Milwaukee, almost all the corporate headquarter buildings are distinctive. They have to try because they have to get you to believe in them as an entity, Northwestern Mutual. What is Northwestern Mutual? It has to be something. The same thing with Marshall and Ilsley Bank when it was built, the building we're in now, the Marine Bank when it was built, the old First Wisconsin building, the gas building, the telephone building. You can keep going on and on. The Pfister Hotel, when it was built, it had to mean something. They were competing with Chicago. Anyways.
So what does this building mean to Northwestern Mutual at this point? Do you
I'm not
think?
So sure that it what it means, but what it is it's a, you know, when you sell buildings by the square foot, which is what the couture is going to be and so forth, you build a building and you do all the engineering, and then you have to think about sort of the minimal amount. We got to put something on it, right? Because what we're really selling are views of people looking out. But I think this, I mean, I hesitate to say what it means, but what it is a thoughtful, rigorous, it's really a visual statement. beautifully set on the site, the way it sweeps around the corner.
You mentioned, it's one of the best buildings to look at as a pedestrian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when you walk down around it, there's that thing that juts out. Not to mention the fact that, and I did this a lot on my bike, and when you're riding your bike down by the art museum, literally it changes, as it sort of rotates from the lake. And I think the lake is the grand view. It sort of rotates and changes, and I illustrated that in the article. You know, what a good building is, I hate to say it, I don't think there's a formula for it. I think it's like Potter Stewart's definition of pornography. You know, I know it when I see it. And it's also fits into the vocabulary of all the existing buildings you've seen. So I think that this building and any building really has to exude two things, quality and somehow refresh, somehow surprise, somehow leave an impression of quality to express the values of their institution.
Do you think it's too simplistic to use the word design here? I mean, it seems like what you're saying is it was well designed.
Oh, yeah. Well, well designed, well executed. I mean, I don't know that much about the execution. But there's a really fancy stone on the back, for example. They made some hard choices or expensive choices when it came to materials. Most buildings are value engineered down. You know, in other words, you have an idea and then you figure out how to make it as cheap as possible. But in this case, they made a lot of choices. The glass, you know, I'm amazed that that is the first really glassy building, the way it reflects the lake. And what's most striking about it is that it's amorphous but clear. And, you know, architects really couldn't do this before the computer. You know, the whole idea of waves, if you notice, everybody does it now. But this was a very articulated surface. So when you as you go on the south, there's all of these vertical rectangles. I think there's more vertical rectangles on this building that are, I wouldn't say they're ornamental, but they're definitely part of the design. It's a very complex design that as it rotates, it really becomes, I mean, I think it's probably 20 or 30, you know, different buildings, depending on where you look.
And the sky. Yeah, what color the sky happens to be and how many clouds and the reflection from the lake. I mean, I've noticed that too. Even just as it was being built, you would see the very, very many moods of the building. And it seems like it has a lot of personalities.
Yeah, it's a fantastic thing to sort of locate yourself. And also, it's sort of like a plant in that it responds to, you know, the conditions. And being on the lake. Now, there is some issues with the building. You know, first of all, I don't think the back, I mean, people have even commented in the article, I think the back is obviously incoherent. And I think it's hilarious that they have their logo on the building, as such as it is, that actually references their old building. So it's something that looks good on stationery. But it's a real, I think it's a real contribution to the public. You know, when I started writing about this many years ago, you know, as you know, I'm an artist, and I would put pictures up in a gallery, 20 pictures or 15 pictures, and two newspapers at the time would write about it. And no one would write about when you put up a building for 30 years. So I just wanted to write about the visual world and what we all see. So it's a great opportunity to celebrate something that is actually, like, interesting to look at. This has, I think this contains sort of the exuberance and joy of what it is to be an architect today and what are the possibilities for a corporation and an architect to collaborate and make something that we want to look at and that's beautiful.
And that we're proud to have on Wisconsin Avenue that's part of our city.
Yeah, it makes it, I mean, I think we underestimate, you know, in the 90s, you know, the whole Walmart thing, the idea of like just make the big box stores and just making things as cheap as possible. I think we forget how proud we were of our building. I mean, look at old-fashioned post offices. When the post office meant something, post offices looked great. I remember mine in Whitefish Bay was this beautiful, modernist building. Now post offices don't mean anything, and they're just, you know, like something in a small shopping mall. And I think to add meaning, and I would hesitate to say what or how it means, but we all know when we look at something like that, that it's you know, it's so articulate, it's so well done that someone is, it's like a fine meal. Someone really worked hard and thought about the details and made something that we can all appreciate.
How do you think it works in the area that it is, the conversation that it has with the other buildings around it and the landscape around it? The Northwestern Mutual building, the big columned one, is literally right next door.
Yep.
How do they talk to each other?
Well, you know, I'm not a big fan of that buildings have to.
Just wondering how you think they talk to
each other. Well, I think it's fairly from, well, I haven't, so I think I might write about the landscaping and the way the building meets the street in a separate article, but it does occur to me that the way the this building connects to the old building is pretty nice. But as far as, you know, having a conversation, I would rather that buildings didn't talk to each other so much. I like people talk, but that's a new urbanist stupid idea. I mean, if buildings had to talk to each other and somehow harmonize with each other, you know, we would have grass buildings or, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. So if you make something really great, then that maybe raises the level of conversation. But so far, so good. And I understand that they've been laying off people. That's often what happens when you build a corporate headquarters. But buildings have to have, good buildings have to have an ego. They have to have somebody that really wants to make it nice. Just like if you get dressed, you know, and you have to have an ego. If you have an ego, maybe you spend a little more money on a suit. No one will notice. And I think that the CEO of the corporation is really, really behind this. And I don't know if he has a big ego, but you need a big ego to make a great building.
And so you think it's a great building?
Well, it's a very good building. You know, it's very similar to some of the other things the architect has done. In other words, they went shopping and they got an expensive, they went and got an A, you know, they went and got the Armani, or maybe not quite, or whatever. I'm not so good on suits anymore. I haven't worn one in a long time. But they went shopping. They got a really good product. They spent a lot of money. And they had the architect do what they do well. And I think this is one of their best buildings, actually, just judging from what's on the web. They got a very good product, if not the best, from the architect.
So going back to what you said about, you know, the building having to have a statement, making a statement, do you think that Northwestern Mutual, once they move into it and they're actually there, and of course they've made a big case about wanting to stay in Milwaukee and about being very proud of being a Milwaukee company, what do you think this is going to do for everybody else? I mean, is this going to engender a sense of pride in the way, say, the Calatrava wing has done, where we've kind of adopted it as the symbol of the city?
You know, I actually don't like symbols, period. And I think that was always a cheap trick, the Calatrava. But I do think that, you know, first of all, this building is on one of the best sites you can build a building, not only in Milwaukee, but in America. Where can you find the central location where there's the art museum there and the lake? It's just an unbelievably fantastic location, very close to where people live, you know. So they inhabit that, and they're building another building as well. So I think it's a fantastic if they want to attract people to come and work in Milwaukee, it's a fantastic thing. And if you couple that with the downtown, you know, all the condominiums and apartments, I think it's a great development. Not to mention the fact that other people, it kind of raises the bar a little bit. I don't think anybody's going to raise the bar beyond Northwestern Mutual. I mean, it is, I think, the largest taxpayer, you know, in probably the state of Wisconsin.
But do you think this is going to affect, say, the Couture?
No.
So it won't have that kind of influence.
No, the Couture is going to be like any commercial building, a contrivance. It's, you know, it has to make money per square foot. Northwestern Mutual isn't going to make money with their building. That's not the idea. The idea is to create a corporate identity, to create it's part of their corporate culture that makes money. These people make money all over the world. It's not a site where you make money. So I think it's going to be great, and I'm looking forward to the landscaping they hired. But from what I understand, a good landscape architect. It's, you know, it's kind of like if they're dressing up to go to a, not a fancy party, but they're dressing up to go to a really nice party, and they want to look nice.
Well, I was going to say, I'm looking forward to the landscaping, too, because one of the things that I do miss during all of this construction is I always loved all of those trees.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it felt like this urban oasis where I could just walk by, and there were these beautiful places where you could just sit in these flowering trees, and it was lovely.
So much nicer than across the street at O'Donnell Park.
Yes.
So, for example, yeah, I always thought it was a nice nook. I would bet, you know, that was done— that last one was done when we didn't really know that much about public spaces, nor do we care about them. So it was a little, I think, corporate. And, you know, there's that little path and there was a little kind of edge thing happening. But I think this is probably going to be a lot nicer. And I just hope that, you know, when the building's done and they spend all this money, that they're going to be able to afford the people to work in it.
Well, you'll have to come back and tell me once the landscaping goes in, we can—
Yeah,
we
no,
can
I'd like to talk about
we can
that.
Have part two of this conversation. Tom Bamberger, as always, it is a pleasure.
Thank you. It was fun.
Photographer and architecture critic Tom Bamberger's review of the new Northwestern Mutual Tower is at Urban Milwaukee, and you'll find a link to it and pictures from WUWM.com.
Coming up next, an Illinois writer whose heart is in the North Woods of Wisconsin shares an essay with us. Marnie Mominga joins us when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Writer Marnie Mominga is a Chicago-area native, but many of her most touching words are written about her family's cabin in the North Woods of Wisconsin.
Mominga's latest book, On a Clear Night, is a collection of essays that include reminiscences of her time in the North Woods, along with the other parts of her life over the years. Here she is with one of the funnier essays, Owner's Manual.
It was a dark and stormy night, or at least in my nightmares it seemed that way. Actually, it was a bright and sunny day when our tire blew out. If it had been a dark and stormy night, we would have really been in trouble. It was difficult enough trying to figure out how to assemble the jack, locate the spare, and find the axle in broad daylight. Current car commercials make one think that the technical engineering of our automobiles would put them right up there with the Mars spacecraft. Alas, somewhere along this high-tech pursuit, someone forgot about keeping the jack and spare tire instructions simple. After our recent experience, I'd put changing a tire right up there with solving a Rubik's Cube. Setting off on a 20-mile trip to town from our cabin on a beautiful fall day in northern Wisconsin, my husband and I heard a weird noise coming from the right side of our car, as if we were dragging a big stick. For once in our lives, we decided not to ignore a car sound we could not identify and stopped to take a look. To our surprise, the back right tire was flatter than a run-over penny on a train track. Turning the car around, we slowly drove the half mile back to the cabin where we would be able to change the tire on the garage floor's hard surface. At least we knew that much. Like a SWAT team, the two of us searched the car for the jack and spare tire to no avail. Finally, my husband discovered the jack, located in a cleverly camouflaged compartment beneath the second-row seat. It consisted of four skinny pipes that looked like Tinkerbell's wand had been in a fight and lost. My husband and I looked at each other in dismay. How the heck did this contraption fit together, and where in the world did it jack up the car? It was time to pull out the owner's manual. Oh, the shame of it, the shame! What dignified, self-respecting person ever reads the owner's manual? And while I'm at it, whatever happened to the good old days when a jack was a jack? In our defense, we are not tire-changing neophytes. We changed our first tire together as dating teenagers on another deserted Wisconsin road in the middle of a forest with only the starlight to guide us. We found the escapade hilarious. My parents, understandably, did not. In addition, I am a veteran witness to tire changing, having grown up in the 1950s when my family of seven experienced a tire blowout on virtually every annual summer vacation to the North Woods and back that I can remember. Sooner or later, on our 450-mile odyssey, the familiar thumpity-thump-thump would resound through the open windows of our packed-to-the-brim station wagon with a canoe on top. With a few swears under his breath, my father would deftly pull the car to the side of an empty country road where a cluster of cows served as our only company. But we didn't panic. We had this tire changing nailed, so to speak. Our biggest challenge was to untie the canoe from the top of the car and unload all the luggage and vacation paraphernalia from the back end of the station wagon in order to retrieve the jack and spare. Back then, even kids knew the spare tire's location. All jacks basically looked the same and always fit next to the wheel well. And no one needed an owner's manual to assemble them, nor was there one even if you'd wanted it. With a few good cranks of the jack, the car rose up faster than a phoenix out of the ashes. A couple of good twists of the wrench, and the bolts came flying off. On went the spare, back went the bolts, back went the belongings in the canoe, and we were back on the road in a matter of hours. Child's play. Unfortunately, the old adage, "Don't fix what ain't broken," got overlooked in the computer age tire tune-up department. And so I have to admit, we opened the owner's manual to the index and looked up jack, page 342. In a flat and halting voice that sounded like Frankenstein's, I slowly read the instructions out loud to my husband. Assemble the jack and jacking tools as shown. Connect jack handle driver A to two extensions B, then to the lug wrench C. Now, ours is not a fancy car. It is a basic American-made model, a medium-sized SUV, but I'll be danged if we couldn't identify the axle where we were instructed to fit the jack because there was so much metal hanging beneath the carriage of the car. Before long, we two grandparents, college-educated with master's degrees, were slithering under the car on the sandy garage floor like a couple of snakes. "I think I found it," I shouted. "Look at this picture on page 344. It matches." We were so happy, we thought we'd won the lottery. Luckily, in our search beneath the car, we also discovered the spare tire. What genius decided to hide it down there is beyond me, because our next quandary was how to disengage it. Back to the owner's manual, page 340. The spare tire is stowed under the rear of the vehicle by means of a cable winch mechanism. To remove or stow the spare, use the jack handle to rotate the spare tire drive nut. The nut is located under a plastic cover at the center rear of the cargo floor area, just inside the lift gate opening. There you have it. Easy as pie. As a bonus, there were enough caution warnings surrounding every direction that I felt I was entering Bill O'Reilly's no-spin zone. Somehow, we figured it out, and slowly, slowly, the spare tire floated down beneath the car like a spaceship twirling in an outer galaxy. Our sense of being in the twilight zone was complete. Eventually, we accomplished our task. The manual's parting note was to stow the tire beauty side up. This must have been an inside joke because, believe me, if there was a beauty side to the tire, I failed to recognize it. Gratefully, we were soon back on the road to town where the nice tire man informed us that our flat tire was ruined. When he replaced the spare a few days later, I watched in wonder as he whipped that tire off and put on the new one in a matter of minutes. Of course, he was using a power jack that would have shot our 2-ton car to the moon. I put one on my Christmas list. Yet, like all good nightmares, mine was not over. Recently, I bought a car seat for my 2 infant granddaughters, and a few mind-boggling attempts to connect it properly, I was beginning to think the tire changing looked easy. As frustrated as a 2-year-old and in fear of going ballistic, I once again succumbed to the instruction manual. Imagine my horror when I read, "Check vehicle owner's manual for the vehicle top tether anchor locations. They may be identified using one of the anchor's symbols. Figure B or Figure C. Pass the Tylenol."
Marnie Mominga reading her essay, Owner's Manual. It's taken from her latest book called On a Clear Night, Essays from the Heartland. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
After a break, Radio Chipstone visits the Museum of Wisconsin Art's exhibit of children's clothes designed by Milwaukee and Florence Eisman. That comes your way next on Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this week, we learned about the Roddus Collection, one of four exhibitions at the Museum of Wisconsin Art dedicated to Wisconsin fashion. Three of those four shows focus on adult fashion, but the fourth exhibition looks at the legacy of an influential Milwaukee designer of high-end children's clothing, Florence Eisman.
Eisman started her iconic company in 1945. By 1955, she'd won a prestigious Neiman Marcus Fashion Award for her designs that are credited for creating the look of the modern child. The company is still very much in business.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Sarah Carter, curator and director of research for the Chipstone Foundation, tells contributor Jennifer Fields about creating the retrospective exhibit, Florence Eisman, Designing Childhood for the American Century.
Most of the exhibition projects that we work on, you start in a library, or you start in an archive. In this case, we started in the factory. So we were quite fortunate that Florence Eisman LLC actually has kept hundreds of garments throughout most of their company history. So we were able to go through those garments and begin to make sense of them. They're not sorted at this point as a traditional archive would, because the company is so interested in history that those garments continue to be used as design inspiration today. They've also saved a number of really amazing scrapbooks from the company's history that helped us. Then we also took a trip to Mount Mary, which has a really excellent fashion collection. And we were able to look at a number of early pieces, early Florence Eisman pieces in their collection that have been donated to Mount Mary. So with those two collections as our starting point, we began to piece together a chronology, and we began to look for key themes that we could pull out of those garments that could help us tell some interesting stories. And that's how we began to think about this post-war periodization as being important, and we began to think about a number of different themes that could help us really begin to tell the story of Florence Eisman, because even though we've written a whole catalog on this topic, the story is still just beginning to unfold, and there are more stories that any one of these garments could tell us.
So then you look at this as a living exhibit. This is something that you will continue to, in some shape or form, add to, work on, continue to build up and flesh out those narratives.
One of the things that's been so exciting with this project is that it very much is a living exhibit. People come into the gallery, they might hear me give a lecture, and they immediately want to tell me their stories. And they want to share their objects, and they want to share their family photographs that have every one of their kids and grandkids wearing a Florence Eisman dress. I've had people telling me stories like, in the 1950s, I wanted to dress my daughter in beautiful Florence Eisman clothes because I was a working mom, and that let everyone know she was well taken care of. I've had other people say they love the factory sales so much that they would bring a little piece of string with them so that they could see exactly how big their child was in comparison to the garments there for sale, to make sure they could get a garment that their child could wear this year so they wouldn't have to wait two more years for him to wear the cute little shortalls. These objects really resonate with people because they connect to their lives, to their families' lives, and they also connect to Milwaukee. I mean, this is a Milwaukee company.
This really does pull you in a sense that not only does it pull you in through the eyes, your eyes as an adult, but it then takes you back to that childhood period. And if you're lucky enough to have had one, it would have been most likely tied to a special event. Your Easter dress, your Christmas dress, your family photo dress.
I have that same experience here. I mean, there are dresses I look at and I think of my next door neighbor who used to wear dresses like that, and we would go to teddy bear teas every year around Christmas. I mean, it's a very emotional, visceral connection to these objects that even though I can study them as a scholar, as a historian, I also have to connect to them as a person who has memories of my own childhood. I connect to them as a mother, thinking about how difficult it was to try to get my son into a Florence Eisman garment. These kinds of garments invite that personal connection, which is something that, as a curator who often works on other materials, I'm always trying to develop and to create, to have someone connect to what we're displaying. But when you're dealing with children's clothing, and especially fantastic children's clothing, like the work that Florence Eisman has been creating for 70 years now, it just happens. Those connections are just made. And as curators and designers, we've been able to facilitate those connections in some interesting ways, hopefully.
What I liked about it, Sarah, is that I know you gave a lecture downstairs before we did this interview, and there were a number of women there. But when they came up here, while they may have been sitting in separate seats across the room from each other, we had to wait to do interviews because it was so loud in here. The cacophony, the stories, the connections that were made. I don't know that I've ever seen that sort of interaction in one exhibit ever before.
There was a real palpable excitement. And I think part of that comes from this realization that the things that these women experienced is the stuff of history, and it's culturally important, and they are participants in these historical patterns, and they have stories that we want to hear and that are valuable.
And particularly in a time where motherhood, when you're taking women who were out of the workforce or who were in the workforce during World War II, bring them out of that workforce, there were women that continued to work, and they faced judgments about working. Right. And this may have been a time period where you not only had the everyday stress of being a mom and being part of a family, but now you're facing these external judgments about how well you do your job.
And what's so powerful for me in terms of talking to many women about these garments is they give them a way to talk about some of those pressures. And whether that pressure is getting the perfect garment for your child, or for some women, they even talked about making Florence Eisenman clothes themselves, buying the fabrics and creating garments so that their children could have these garments as well. But thinking about how these garments might suggest both the pleasures and the pressures of motherhood, and how those things so often go together. And also thinking about parents' roles in trying to create what some scholars have talked about as a sense of wondrous innocence for your children or childhood, creating a feeling of wonder. And that wonder could be having all of your children wearing matching clothes and having this very special moment on a family vacation or at the holidays where you're creating a beautiful image that you will treasure for years. Or that wonder could be having your child wear a dress that might have a whole range of funny aprons or pinafores that they could wear, like some of the really wonderful doll-shaped pinafores in the exhibition. But creating that sense of wonder is in some ways both a pleasure and a pressure of motherhood. And these clothes can help you begin to think about that complexity.
Talk to me about the design and the look of this exhibition.
We were quite fortunate to be able to work with Brent Budsberg, who's an amazing exhibition designer. And we took various historical cues to help us design different parts of the exhibition here at MOA. And what we're looking at here in this section is a room that is inspired by a presentation drawing made by Chicago architect and designer Henry P. Glass. And he created this for a Chicago fabric company, and it's a presentation design for a company selling tiny little children's clothes on forms in these wonderful, strange, amoeba-shaped shadow boxes and with this great mid-century-inspired furniture and with this really interesting ceiling installation. And so what we were thinking about in selecting this as a design source is that we wanted visitors to feel like they were actually there in the 40s when Florence Eisenman and Florence Eisenman started selling these garments at Marshall Fields in Chicago. And there are several other moments like that throughout the exhibition where we're not just putting the clothes on display with labels, but we're trying to create an experience that invokes memories, that connects to the garments, that allows visitors to see them not just as works of art on the wall, but as garments that existed in a specific historical context. I think the women in this space felt welcomed in, and they felt that they could look closely and that they had something valuable to say about the garments on display, which of course they do. And these kinds of design interventions invite that sort of conversation because we're really thinking about their experience. We're thinking about what it feels like to be in this space, and we are trying to make it feel comfortable, interesting. We're trying to transport them to another world, which is part of what museums do. They take you out of your daily life and they bring you somewhere else. And in this case, we are trying to invite visitors into an historical moment when they can look at these garments, think about these garments, connect, remember, and then think about how the things that they might have worn, that their children might have worn, or their grandchildren might have worn, or their aunt or niece or nephew might have worn, can connect them to some pretty big themes in American cultural history and American art history.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
Stick around. The latest edition of X-Fabula is up next on Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWN.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X-Fabula!
True personal story.
X-Fabula!
X-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
X-Fabula Radio Time on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bruce Winter with X-Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney, and we have a third person in the house today. I'll let you take it from here.
Mystery guest, indeed. Before I introduce our mystery guest, I just wanted to say that last month was our final X-Fabula Story Slam of Season 8, and we ended it with a bang, and we couldn't have done it without all of the help from our fantastic volunteers. Whether you're a board member, you serve on an X-Fabula committee, or you volunteer at the Story Slams, we just want to give you a special shout out. And with that, I brought in one of our fantastic volunteers, Carolina. Carolina is a public ally who was placed at X-Fabula, and she's become our community connectors. I kind of wanted to ask you, you know, how was your experience with X-Fabula this past year helping us out as a community connector?
Well, I started in September, and it's been really wonderful getting to know more of the Milwaukee organizations that I didn't already know, and meeting people on pretty much a daily basis. It's been a really valuable experience for me.
Yeah, you kind of have to like humans with X-Fabula, right?
No, and I've grown to like humans a lot more in the last year.
That's fantastic. What do you think that's a direct result from?
I don't know. Yeah. Probably hearing people's vulnerability all the time.
Why don't we speak a little bit? Because we do have a volunteer orientation coming up. Do you have anything?
Yes. So as part of my position, I do the volunteer coordination. So I work daily with volunteers, sort of getting them organized, situated. And as part of that, we have volunteer orientations. So we're going to have one on June 27th at the Washington Park Library from 6 to 7 p.m. And you're able to register online at xfabula.org/volunteers and sort of go through the survey. And then I will contact you. And then we can get together and talk about X-Fabula volunteering. If you want to be on a board, a committee, or just attend the slams as someone who welcomes everybody.
Yeah, so basically the only prerequisite is that you have to like humans.
You must like humans, otherwise it might be a difficult job for you.
Yeah, very painstaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. And thank you so much for coming in and joining us today in the studio.
You.
Stick around. We're about to roll into our actual regular scheduled programming with Bruce over here. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there. Hey, let me guess, because it's Father's Day weekend. We have had a lot of stories about dads over the years.
Yes.
I'm guessing we got father's stories today.
We do, actually. We have a little bit of a different spin on this week's stories, though. We're going to be talking about what it is to choose to be a father. So with that, we are going to start out the show with a story from Matthew Conkle, who told a story at one of our spectaculars back in 2013 at Turner Hall Ballroom, where the theme was bad company. So let's listen to Matthew's story.
I've had some bad company in my life, visitors I felt I could do without. But in this particular situation, this bad company was not going to listen to any type of aggressive reasoning or intellectual persuasion to incite it to leave. My bad company was very much a part of me, and it required something a bit more extreme to have it removed from the situation. This bad company I speak of is that carrier of information, that persistent fertilizer, that seed of seeds known as spermatozoa. In 1995, I had a vasectomy. I was 25 years old at the time, without children, and I was not at all interested in cultivating any garden saplings. In my case, I was more than content to leave going forth and multiplying to others because procreating was not for me. At 25 years old, I decided that my seeds of bad company had long overstayed their welcome at the Johnson Gardens, and they needed to be banned from the premises permanently. As far as I was concerned, my swimmers had spent enough time in the pool, and it was time that they got out and hung up their trunks and goggles and were on their merry way. Now, let me make a couple of things clear. One, I have tremendous respect for parents. It's probably the most difficult job in the world. My mother and father, I don't know how they raised four boys. It's for some people, it's a great choice. And two, I love kids. I love working with kids. All of the multiple jobs that I hold to make ends meet have something to do with young people and arts education. I love their raw, creative energy. That's something that I feed off of. And I love how willing they are to just jump right in and try. And I love that when my job of teaching them art skills is over, that they go to someone else's home. At 25 years old, I made a decision not to have children. And I made that decision very early in life because I knew that it was something that I didn't want. In 1995, after 2 years in a relationship, I simply could not handle the stress anymore of my girlfriend being late. And I don't mean late to work. I mean that kind of late, which it seemed like she was a lot, and the subsequent stress of waiting for the results of the pregnancy tests. I needed something that was 100% effective all the time before I went completely out of my not wanting to father a child mind. The stress was having an effect on my health, and I couldn't concentrate, so finally I just decided to get the thing done so I could stop worrying about it. I had to go to three different urologists before I found one who was willing to give me the operation. Me being 25 at the time and childless, most were reluctant to perform the procedure. And I had to explain every time how my decision to not have children was very lucid. It was not something that I'd simply decided upon in the commercial break between Seinfeld and Frasier. It was, I had thought about it for a couple of years and, you know, done some research on the procedure and talked to other people and got other people's opinions. And I knew that it was going to be the best thing for me in my life. On the day of the operation, I had my brother drive me in. On the way there, he asked me, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Now, my brother had gotten a vasectomy about a year earlier, and I was going to the same urologist. He was a new doctor in town and was setting up a new practice, and he had agreed to waive his fee, so I expected to get the procedure done for less than $200. "Are you sure you want to do this?" my brother asked. I turned to him, nodded, and said yes. So I go in for the operation. It's actually really a very simple procedure. You're in and out in less than an hour. Probably the most difficult part about it is that first initial shot of anesthetic that they give you to neutralize the security in the area that they're going to be breaching. After that, you're just on your back, ironically in a birthing pose. Trying not to think that there's anything weird about two men poking around the groceries inside your bag. So, but maybe worse than the anesthetic is later that day when the painkiller wears off. Yeah, 2 days with a bag of ice between your legs might be paradise for some people, but I found it uncomfortable. I don't know. That's just me. After the operation, they tell you that it'll take 10 to 12 rocket launches before you're spaceman free. So my girlfriend at the time agreed to operate the command center to oversee the gathering of the sample for testing. So we got the sample and took it in, and 2 days later they called and said that the bad company had been officially and permanently jettisoned. I never told my parents I was getting the operation, and I only recently officially told them. Not that they were surprised. I pretty much figured that my parents knew by this time, I'm 43, that I was not all too keen on the fathering role. I have three older brothers. They all have children, so my parents were never lacking for grandchildren to spoil. I've told a few select people over the years, but mostly I've kept the information between me, myself, and other women that I've been intimate with. Reactions from the women have varied to blank stares, to "you what?" to "that's great." I've made a fair number of bad decisions in my life, but I never had any regrets about getting this decision, never had any regrets about getting this operation. If I had ever fathered a child, I feel confident that I would have made a good parent, but I also feel that my heart would not have been 100% in it, and that's not good, because then there's a chance that I would become the bad company to that child, and that's not something that I was interested in doing. So I made the decision to get it done, and it allowed me to focus my attention on creative pursuits like writing and theater. So I'm really happy I got rid of the bad company, because it was one of the best decisions I ever made. Thank you.
And that was Matthew Conkle's bad company story.
Electing not to be a father at an early age,
yes,
which is somewhat unusual, but, you know, a well-thought-out decision on his part.
Indeed. So we're just going to switch up the gears a little bit. We're going to go into a different story from Sean Mitchell, who told a story at our Fatherhood Story Slam back in February 2016. We had an event, a Story Slam event at 3041 North, which is a fantastic event space that you can contact them for anything. We contacted them to do a Story Slam there. They were very happy about it. We were very happy about it. Let's listen to Sean Mitchell's story about choosing to break the cycle. Here's Sean Mitchell.
I grew up without my father. My father left us when I was 5 years old. Never really got a chance to meet him, never talked to him on the phone, anything of that nature. So growing up, I always had this desire for a father or to be a father. It became a drive for me that I wanted to be somebody's daddy, right? Even to the point where when my girlfriend was pregnant by someone else, I told her I was the father and we were going to pretend that way. So, TMI maybe, but it's okay, it's okay. We're sharing, stand by. anyway, I had this longing to become a father. I don't know if it was just to be a father or if it was to take care of someone as my mother and my grandfather had taken care of me. I got that opportunity and in 1992, I became a father for the first time, right? And I love the boy to this day. I kept him around. You know, I didn't give him away or nothing. And so as life went on, I had two sons. And about 2006, after being a widower and being divorced, I was a single father with two children, and I found a woman who became the love of my life. We met in 2006, and we never separated. She had two sons, I had two sons. So then I was becoming a father of a blended family. I was transitioning once again from just a single father, and then a married father, and then a widowed father. You know, I was really transitioning in fatherhood. But at the time, I really didn't notice it. To me, it was an everyday kind of struggle. You know, they've got to get to school, they've got to eat, you know, they can't wear the same underwear all the time, you know, we got to do something at night, we can't just watch TV, we got to get up, they got to be educated, right? So, okay, in 2006, I met my current wife. She had two children, two sons as well, and it just so happened that they were all around the same ages. So, as life moved on, we began to have life, we got in, I don't want to say trouble, but we got pregnant, okay? And don't quote me on the date, but it was probably 2007 or so, and we were pregnant. Unfortunately, I also had to experience the fatherhood. In my fatherhood, I also had to experience losing a child, so we miscarried. And at the time, we didn't want to go through this again. We had you know, four sons. We were fine. Everybody was doing great. Two of our older sons were getting ready to go to college. The other two were in the middle of high school. We were fine. So I made an appointment to go and have a vasectomy. I was going to cut it, and we weren't going to do it again. All right? So However, I procrastinated. And my procrastination caused us to get pregnant again. And now we have 5 sons. The youngest is now 4, and the oldest is 25. But through all of these experiences, fatherhood has taught me so much. That longing for someone to express my love to was always being fulfilled. Now I have the pleasure of trying to pay attention to their lives and see where I can fit in. I try to figure out one thing that they like that I can learn more about so I can be a better father for them. So that I can address that one thing for each one of them. The one thing that I did not have. It would have saved me from a lot of trouble, but then again, the experiences that I had brought me to the point I am today.
And that was Sean Mitchell telling us his fatherhood story.
To be a father or not to be a father, that was our theme today. And if you want to hear these stories again or share today's Ex Fabula Radio, it is at WUWM.com. And all information regarding Ex Fabula is at one place.
Exfabula.org.
Exfabula.org.
Indeed. Thank you, Carlina, for coming in today.
Yeah.
And, you know, the role that people like you play in organizations like Ex Fabula is important not only to the organization but the community, and we thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you much.
Ex Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune in to the weekday version of our show at 10 in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.